I'm Erica Ensign.
And I'm Lisa Schmeiser.
And we welcome you back to the saga of rereading epics, in which we are rereading, reconsidering, and re-feeling Julian May's Saga of Pleistocene Exile and Galactic Milieu series. We are now in the midst of the Galactic Milieu, and that's right, we have now read Diamond Mask, our first female protagonist that's, like, pretty protagonist-y, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great way of putting it.
I was like,
our first one who's not likely to be turned into ash by the end of it.
Yep. And, I mean, the book is named after her, so I think I was expecting even more of her being center stage, but it still centered, you know, Rogi and Jack and some other people a little bit more than I was expecting. Not necessarily a complaint, just a difference than what I was expecting.
Yeah. And I just, yeah. You know, remember they talk about Jack the Bodiless and Saint Alucio the Martyr in the first four books. And I honestly thought that with something like Saint Alucio the Martyr, it would be somebody who was a shapeshifter.
You know, you're right. That that sort of conjures up an image of, you know, illusions and stuff. And that's totally not what she's about.
Yeah, no, like, because you hear Saint Jack the Bodiless and Saint Alucio. And what I think is that's like the perfect set of post-human metapsychic saints, if you will, because it just points out that at this point it's a civilization where physical supremacy doesn't count as much as your mental capacity and your metapsychic abilities. And so, and bear in mind, you know, the first time you run into their names, you're in a book that's already asked you to accept the premise of time traveling and aliens who have hewed to a medieval lifestyle and all this other stuff. So, like, why not? Saint Jack and Alucio. And then when you read Diamond Mask, which I think is a very tricky and challenging book, as well as being like a fantastic middle book in a trilogy. Mm-hmm. You read that and you're like, oh, that's what she is.
You know,
it's
you're
all
right
about shifting identity. She doesn't shapeshift.
Sadly, no. Well, I mean, I guess her physical shape shifts at the end when she gets burned, but that's not quite the same thing. But you mentioned it being a fantastic middle book, and I really agree. I feel like, once again, Julian May is showing her prowess at being able to structure a series of books, because this is very clearly, you know, the stuff that's happening after the first book, and there's certainly more to come. That's been set up, you know, very blatantly, especially at the end of the book. but this still feels like a coherent story. It's sort of like the Diamond Mask story, the D story, or Dorothée, or whatever you want to call her. I love the section about how Rogi goes through all the different names that she has and who gives them to her. But it's centered around her to some extent, but like the other stuff that's happening at the same time feels to me like that's the connecting hole. We're getting the politics of the universe every time we dip into somebody else's life, and then we zip back over to whatever's going on with her, and it's really her becoming Alucio, becoming this this person that is such an important figure on the galactic stage. Like, she, by the end of this book, has finally become the person that we heard about, you know, 6 million years ago, and it's kind of interesting and fun to watch her become that person and grow up. I mean, interesting and fun, and sometimes painful, because it's not the most fun life in a lot of ways.
Well, it's I feel like this is the book where May begins to embroider a lot of her themes, and she begins to haul out a lot of her philosophies. And one of the things that occurred to me while I was reading it is the arc of this book makes it clear that at some point, Dory, whatever you want to call it, Diamond Mask, Dorothée or Dory and Jack are going to become partners. And that's the end point that's in the back of your mind the whole time you read the book, because they're already paired together in the public imagination and in the narrative imagination by the time you start this book. It's just a question of how to get the pieces together. And May inserts a little bit of conflict that, whatever. So she's mad that Jack reaches out to her. But what I found interesting on a deeper level is you have on one hand a person whose family shaped the culture of metapsychic Earth in a really significant way. Like, this is Jack the Bodiless, who's grown up in this, who's grown up basically cradled in a family that may not have wanted him born, but once he was here, they showed an amazing amount of solidarity. Mm-hmm. And then you have Doro's really sad and terrible family situation where her mother explicitly rejects her because she's not operant from birth. We're introduced to her and her brother Kenny as small children when they're like 5 and 7, and they're already saying that their mother doesn't consider them to be quote unquote true people.
Yes.
And like, she's just always disappointed and hostile towards them. Mm-hmm. And so when she grows up, she's got this much different relationship to metapsychic citizenship and to Unity, but she's also fearsomely talented. And the whole thing is about Dorothy becoming a true person, as it were, so she can meet Jack. And by the end of the book, I think my biggest thing was, I'm not sure Jack ever really earns her, if that makes sense.
Mm. Yeah. I do want to just point out for anybody who hasn't read the books, because apparently there are people listening along who have not read these books or haven't in a long time.
Wild! That, why?
Right?
Why? Tell us why.
I don't know, but I love it. I love you. Uh-huh. I love you, listeners. I love all our listeners.
I just want to know what you're thinking.
But I just want to point out that true people is a term that is used by the metapsychics in this book. Like, in
refer to each other. And yes, if you're not metapsychic, you're not quote unquote true people.
Yeah, it's so sort of like the inverse of muggles in the Harry Potter books. Like, the muggles, yes, are the people who don't have magic, and the people who
basically
do have powers are true people, all one word often.
What I found really interesting is this reminds me also of like the central tension in all of the X-Men comics, where the mutants are like, you know, homo superior or homo mutandis or whatever, and homo sapiens is this, that's the end of their run, evolutionarily speaking. And there's a little bit of that too. And while on one hand I can appreciate that she's a good storyteller, and so who wouldn't take the opportunity to ask and answer the question, how does a metapsychic parent deal with having a non-metapsychic kid? Like, that's rich and dramatic. It's just hard to read.
It is. And especially because it's two generations of this same thing happening.
Yes.
Because you have, you know, Masha, who is Dee's grandmother, who had, you know, basically the history repeats itself. She's this brilliant metapsychic who marries a guy that she falls head over heels in love with, but he is not operant. And eventually things break down because they're not, you know, living on the same page. And she's got a son who is not
she
operant.
She has four kids, and only one of them is non-operant.
And of course, he's the one that she doesn't have a great, strong relationship with.
No, she packs him off to his father. And then he meets like this promising student of hers, and once again,
who happens to be operant.
And then once again, like, chemistry rears its head, and they get married. And when she has the children, she's like, wait, I married this guy that I can't commune with psychically. I'm living in the
hinterlands.
End of the universe on a farm with a baby I can't even talk to psychically. And, you know, I think I would feel more sympathy for her, or for either of these generations of fools. I would feel more sympathy for them if they had any empathy to go along with this presumably superior array of mental powers. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we actually see through this book over and over is a lack of, I wouldn't say a lack, for a bunch of psychics who can root around each other's heads, there's not a whole lot of empathy. And that raises the question, do you just not have to cultivate it because you can know what someone else is thinking instead of trying to put yourself in their shoes? Or is this a shortfall on the author's part with her imagination? Or is this a deliberate choice arguing that when you are restructuring a society and arguing over ethics, empathy takes a back seat? Like, I don't have a good answer to that. I'm just a little bothered by it.
Yeah, it's interesting too. And like, it occurs to me that, you know, she's come up with all of these different basically superpowers that humans are evolving into. And she could have very easily had one of those superpowers be like an overdeveloped sense of empathy and ability to, you know, an either ability or like just, you know, not being able to stop sharing the feelings of other people. But I think that would have really changed the story that she, like the story she wanted to tell didn't have all that nasty empathy in there.
No.
And it's more a cerebral viewing of how these powers affect people and the universe and society and all that kind of stuff. And I agree. It would have been nice to have at least a couple of characters in there where empathy was sort of like the more important thing. Honestly, I feel like Kenny, her older brother, Dee's older brother, is maybe in this book the most empathetic character that we have. Like he's barely in it, but I love him so much because he is just
when his powers came online, he used them secretly to keep Dee's bullies from bullying her.
Yes, and he supports her no matter what she does, and he keeps her secrets, and he goes on to use his, you know, when his powers are found out, he uses them to help other people who are in his situation, and then like, and he gets to have one of the rare weddings in these books that's actually happy. Like, he marries Luke Rimlard, who was another character that was not in the earlier books very much, but when he was, I really liked him because he just seemed like a sweet kid. So I was happy to see those two crazy kids get together.
Yeah, me too. Plus, it's a wedding scene. Who doesn't love wedding scenes? But to get back to your point, where you're right, empathy could have been one of those, one of the meta powers. And I get that May is telling the story that she's telling, because one of the central narrative tensions that she comes back to again and again is the idea of, do you put your talents and your time to your own self-interest, or do you put your talents and your time towards something for a greater good and a greater ideal? Like, we saw that Aiken Drum doesn't become a real human being and a quote unquote a real king until he chooses to do that. You know, we saw it with, you see that one of the flaws with Amory that ultimately leads to her death is, you know, she struggles against her own sense of self until she finally, like, you know, submits to the church, submits to the will, submits to her own murder. Yeah. And like, that's a big thing with May. That's a huge theme and clearly something that interests her. But I think it would have been a very interesting story if empathy had been one of the powers, along with redaction and telekinesis and all that, because not every meta is created equally. So if you had a couple that were like, you know, super empathetic, compared to ones who are not that strongly empathetic, the argument over what unity is and whether or not to join it would have been a lot different.
Oh, yeah.
And it would have been really interesting, because what happens if you've got somebody with both empathy and off the charts coercive power? So, and I realize we're having this discussion about empathy, and it occurs to me, maybe this is not the kind of discussion we would have had when we read these books back when they came out. Whereas we're living in a time now where, thanks to the internet and the ability for people to put forth their first person narratives over social media, over podcasts, over websites, over art, over YouTube, we're able to empathize with each other, and we realize that it's one of the most powerful tools we have for creating understanding and connection. Whereas that probably didn't have the same, we wouldn't have been thinking about it in the same way like 30 years ago when this book came out. So this is definitely one of those things where you're like, oh, this is something we pick up on reread, because the Lisa and Erica who are reading these books in 2020 are very different from the Lisa and Erica who are reading these books in the mid-90s.
Totally. Yeah. I do want to circle back to what you said about Dee and Jack and him not exactly earning her. I feel like that's true. And to me, it kind of felt like a bit of an old, like she, that May fell into a bit of an old fashioned romance trope where
in fairy tales
and like sometimes older movies, especially I've been watching a lot of movies from like the 30s and 40s and stuff. And because, you know, you have sort of like a truncated amount of time to shove stuff in there, the romance sort of happens fast and there's a lot of just stuff that's sort of elided and you just sort of assume, oh, that was a really big moment for them there. So yes, now they are in love. And I realize a novel is not the same thing, but because this story of Dee and Jack getting together is only part of this giant tapestry that she is weaving together, we do get, you know, the two of them having their own separate lives. And then towards the end of the book, we get, you know, Uncle Rogi trying to tell the, you know, why Jack wants to possibly sacrifice his life for this, you know, planet that's at the, as you were going to say, ass end of the universe. And like, you know, the reason that he's going to do that, I could tell you. And she just sort of like ignores him and walks away, even though we as the readers obviously know by now that he's in love with her. Like that part, I'm okay with Jack being in love with her because it's shown that he has been kind of keeping an eye on her throughout her life, which is, you know, maybe moderately creepy. But on the other hand, yeah, she starts out really hating him. And there is that trope, that romance trope, that like, you know, hate, there's a fine line between hate and love. And where you have a really strong emotion towards someone when the switch is flipped and you recognize that the things that you thought were true are not actually true, because she learns the actual truth about him, that maybe that is the trope that we're supposed to believe, that like, okay, she recognizes that he's not actually trying to trick her into doing anything and he never was. So all of that emotion has to go somewhere, and now suddenly it's turned into love. But the amount of time that they have together is, well, we know how much time it is. It's 14 hours because that's how long it takes for their little vehicle to travel, you know, down into the crust of the planet Caledonia. So, I mean, I'm thinking back to my teenage years and even later. And, you know, when you're that age, there's a lot of hormones. Even if you can, you know, subtly redact your own hormones, they're still in there. They're still doing stuff. And I've had definitely some nights of conversation with people I was attracted to that, you know, were just like 5 hours of really intense conversation. And that was enough to make me be like, yes, I'm totally in love. So I'm not saying that Jack earned her, but I am saying that her, the way that she turned kind of almost on a dime, does ring as sort of true to me, having gone through similar situations.
It's a little, it's plausible. I think of it almost, you read the Little House on the Prairie books, didn't you?
Yes, but it was a long time ago.
So there's, in these happy golden years when Laura and Almanzo Wilder are courting, like horses always feature into it. Like, because she gets behind. Oh, it's the cutter. He comes to get her when she's got the teaching gig, and it's the team prince and lady. And then he takes her on buggy rides, and then they break a couple teams of horses together. And that's kind of their thing. And when she consents to marry him, Ma says, I'm not sure whether you love him or the horses. And she says, I couldn't have one without the other. And then in the not sequel, but the book that is arguably not part of the set, it's the first 4 years, which Laura wrote, but didn't get polished. It didn't get published until after the literary estate fell into other hands. There's a line about the first summer when Laura and Almanzo are married. And remember, she's a teenager when she gets married. She's 16. Her husband's older. And they basically spend the summer, you know, farming. And then when they're done with their chores, they hop on horses and ride all around the prairie. And she writes that when they're on horseback, they're as, quote unquote, as thoroughly in sympathy as two people can be. And so I always had this thing in my head that she loves him and she loves the horses, and it's all mixed up together. Mm. And it kind of makes sense to me that Dorothy begins to love Jack because she loves Caledonia, her planet, so much that when he comes to help her with it, because it matters to her. you know, she mm-hmm. loves him because she loves Caledonia and he helps save Caledonia. And that's a little bit mixed up in there too.
Yeah, that makes sense too, because especially like at the very end, and like there's a lot of really important stuff that's kind of jammed in at the very
end. Like the last 10 pages. You're yeah. like, wait, what? Yeah.
So like, you know, we learn how, you know, she's gotten very terribly badly burned and she doesn't have time to go into a regen tank to get that all fixed because her people are so important to her. This is her planet yeah. that she is, you know.
Her planet very nearly blew up. There's a lot of stuff that still has to be done. Yeah.
So she's going around and like earlier in the book, it had been laid out very, I think, a little bit more nicely and clearly how she felt so inadequate to the job mm-hmm. that she had been put to. Like, you know, she becomes the second in command, deputy dirigent.
Deputy dirigent, yeah.
And she doesn't feel like she has earned it. She thinks she just has it because she happens to have these paramount grandmaster mind powers.
Yeah.
And she doesn't think that that's enough. And while the people like her as she's traveling around as when she first gets the job, it's more like she's a mascot and she thinks that they just, you know, see her as, oh, look, she's a cute, small woman who has these really strong powers and she mm-hmm. came from our planet. So, yay, you know, she's our mascot. Mm-hmm. And at the end, because Jack has helped her save her planet and because she, you know, went through this awful, excruciating pain of having mm-hmm. to be burned and stuff, and she decides to just cover herself up until she can be healed. She's got this really fancy diamond encrusted, like, you know, it's kind of a Darth Vader basically mm-hmm. mask that just, yeah. you know, covers the lower part of her face. It allows her to breathe. It allows her to take in water and sustenance. And then her silver flight suit, which I just always thought that silver flight suit was a cool idea. And then the fact that she covers it in rhinestones and then replaces mm-hmm. the rhinestones with actual diamonds is just like delightful to me.
So she decides the diamonds from the explosion that she interacted. So that's she's like the ultimate trophy.
Isn't it great? So she's wearing this around and the sort of two, the paired things of the fact that she helped save the planet and mm-hmm. that all these people live on and the fact that she's wearing like this, you know, bling everywhere. Everybody starts to sort of see her and respect her for her prowess and her abilities and her power. And that is super important to her as a character. Mm-hmm. We know more about her internal life than I think, you know, any other character that we've dealt with in a long, long time. So yeah. The fact that Jack is not only wrapped up in saving her planet, but because he's wrapped up in the saving the planet, he's also wrapped up in bringing the planet, the people of the planet, to appreciate her for reasons that she feels are valid, I think mm-hmm. is another thing that is really important. You know, she has, she's seen as a person who is worthy, and Jack was a big part of that. So there's a lot of that stuff wrapped up in together. So I like your analogy about the horses. It makes sense.
Well, you talk about this whole book is about Dorothy trying to seek validity. First, mm-hmm. she never gets it from her mother. Nope. And that's one of the core components of her trauma, ironically enough, yeah. is that she doesn't ever really get validation from her biological family. And so she effectively has to find and create ways of getting it for herself. And like you said, she earns it from her people, or rather she feels that she earns it from her people through her diligent work and her integrity and her obvious love of Caledonia, and then her willingness to sacrifice herself for it and to not just faff off into a regen tank when they need her the most. But the other way she earns it for herself is when she goes and she confronts her mother's killers. Mm-hmm. And she has that long, long afternoon of the soul where she realizes that she was carrying a lot of anger and resentment toward her mom. And that for all the guilt she has over not stopping Hydra when she witnessed the murder, at the same time, she was also like vicariously experiencing it with maybe not approval, but understanding because of her feelings towards her mom. And so she has to come to terms with the uglier side of her personality and her childhood trauma and own it and forgive her mother, basically, mm-hmm. so she can forgive herself so that she can do what's right rather than what feels good. And it is perhaps like the most, like you said, other than Rogi, we've always gotten a good look at Rogi's mental and moral gymnastics. This is the only other character May ever really gives that to.
Mm-hmm. And I think she does a really good job of of portraying it, because, I mean, you know, I was once a young girl as well, who also struggled with, you know, what the world expected of me and all that kind of stuff. I luckily didn't have the same kind of, you know, trauma with being mad at my mom and then having my mom taken from me and all that kind of stuff. But I thought the idea that, like, Rogi's description of her at the beginning of this book, and maybe even at, a little bit at the end of the previous one, talking about how she wore a mask way before she wore a mask. And I thought that was amazing that you have this 5-year-old girl who is not showing the adults in her life how she actually feels. And I remember moments like that of being a kid and being like, feeling like I needed to put a different face to the world than what I was actually feeling inside, just to you know, make the people around me feel better. And
Or because you didn't want to deal with their reaction if you were 100% your unfilled.
It was very striking to sort of like get that feeling from a character who is so young. And as she grows and, you know, more and more layers of this come out, like she really is, as Rogi puts it, always wearing a mask over herself. And, you know, it's kind of a nicely done narrative trick, I think, to tie everything all together.
You know, for all that the Remillard family tends to treat Uncle Rogi like an idiot.
He's pretty insightful sometimes.
Well, I think the thing that, and I realize part of this is narrative convenience, because you can't have him as the guy who's ostensibly writing these books without having an excuse to have all these people confide in him.
Yes.
But I think if you step back from that for a moment, what it says about him as a character is maybe he is the one person whose meta power is empathy, because he does a great job of maintaining connections with a lot of people who are otherwise either incredibly prickly or very nearly not human, like Mark and Anne. What I found interesting in this book is there's a couple... There's a lot of allusions to how separated metapsychics are from the rest of society, or rather from the rest of humanity, and how separate and alien they can feel to each other and to themselves too. But the one thing they all have in common is Rogi's unconditional love and acceptance of them. There's a scene where Dorothy befriends Rogi. She comes into the bookshop to get a gift for Kenny. And because he's, you know, warm and avuncular and all of that, she drops by. It actually turns out it's making her job more enjoyable, because she's determined to find out who Fury is. She's pinned it down to it's got to be somewhere in the Remillard family. So while she's forging this friendship with Rogi, and they're birdwatching buddies together, and she comes by and he's like a surrogate uncle when she's this young girl in Dartmouth and all that, she's also like mentally interrogating him and poking around the corners of his memories and amassing intelligence on everybody.
Yeah.
And he calls, and he finally, he calls her on it, because it turns out that she's been doing a little bit of long-term brain damage that Severin has to undo. And at one point she talks to him and she's like, listen, I've assessed the risk factor for which one of you guys is Fury, because I'm convinced that Fury is a separate personality that none of you guys know about. They occasionally pop up to take control of somebody's brain and then they submerge again.
Although she didn't know that at first. It was Rogi that told her that it possibly could be a separate, like a multiple personality disorder thing going on, and she's like, well, I'll have to adjust my math, but this, you know, this still stands.
Like, and what she notes, because I remember I highlighted it, is she's like, all right, the two most probable members of the dynasty who would be Fury, because she didn't have data on Jack or Mark yet, she needed to go get it, but at the time she tells Rogi, she's like, it's either Paul, who was the only one of that cohort of siblings who got trained in utero by aliens and is head and shoulders above his siblings, or Anne, who she says has enough emotional dysfunction to make her very nearly not human anyway.
Right. That and, was surprising to me.
And, well, it's... I want to get into how May writes her women, because this is like a great example, and the contrast of Anne and Catherine comes up a lot anyway. But, you know, at the end of it, it's fitting that Anne is the one who comes in to talk to Rogi and drop what is like one of the best endings in any number two book in a trilogy in history there.
Yeah. And like, we might as well say it because, you know, anybody who's listening either has read the book or has not read the book and doesn't care about spoilers on this book. The very, very last line of this book is,
it's so good.
He's like, so Rogi's going on for a couple paragraphs about how he feels so great. You know, Caledonia is saved and they're going to get married and yay, it's wonderful. Last line, which is its own paragraph. And then Anne Remillard spoiled it all by coming into my bookshop and telling me that Dennis was Fury. And I was just like, mic drop, like, baby.
I can remember reading that because I bought this book in Magnificat, like in hardback, like at a time in my life when hardback books were just gross indulgence compared to the paperback book. Mm-hmm. And I just remember reading this and be like, what? Mm-hmm. And it's still phenomenal, but it's a lot of this comes down to, are you a true person or are you not? And the irony is that Viola Strachan, for all that she thinks of herself as a true person, she's a monstrous parent. Yep. and just so not a very nice person, period. Mm-hmm.
She is so driven. And this is, this kind of comes back to the idea that we had in the first four books about like how you can't necessarily be a mother and also have a career. And like, this is another example of it because Viola is a brilliant academician and she has this great career and it all has to, you know, it's all wrapped up with operancy. And now she's got, you know, these children who are like, they have latent talents and if only they could just bring them out. So, you know, she spends so much time trying to use the pain that we also learned about in the first four books. Like you can bring people to operancy through pain and puts her kids, like her children who are clearly way younger than five when they start doing this, through all these painful procedures to try to bring them from latency up to operancy because that would make them true people. There's that word again. And the kids don't necessarily want it. And she does. There's never any indication that Viola actually recognizes that is something that Dee is, you know, sort of shying away from, that she just doesn't want it. Like she wants to please her mother so badly, but she also wants to stay true to herself and what she actually wants, which is to stay latent and just be the person that she is. Ugh, like poor kid.
And the thing is, like, it's not like Viola did this out of love for her children.
Nope.
Because that's the difference between if you're a parent who has to put your kid through physical therapy or any other type of regimen that is going to be uncomfortable, but ultimately assists in recovery from an injury or assists in meeting developmental milestones. That's one thing. But there was nothing wrong with these kids other than the fact that they were latent. And she didn't put them through it because she loved them and wanted something better for them. She put them through it because she didn't think of them as human until they were psychic.
Yeah.
But what to get back to this whole Julian May's approach to parenthood just fascinates me.
It's something.
Well, it's fascinating because the other thing that we have going on is Fury comes to Dorothy in her dreams. Mm-hmm. A lot, and takes the form of her mother, where Dorothy is having quote-unquote lucid dreams where it's her mother talking to her and I have these plans for you, this is a new age. And so between the tortured real life mother child relationship they had, and then with the simulacra that Fury offers, like those are two jacked up examples. Mm-hmm. Catherine Remillard is largely written off by the rest of the family, which I find amazing. Mm-hmm. and then, you know, there's also a lot of dead mothers when you think about it, because Teresa Kendall echoes down, Viola dies, and then one of Paul's mistresses dies in a terrible, terrible way.
And this was, that actually reminded me of the previous book where we kept getting these hints about, like, you know, Mark, how he was born in a mysterious, like, bad circumstances. And we later find out he was a twin who killed his twin in utero. Yeah. And here they keep saying yes. And Laura Tremblay died in this, you know, terrible way. And then when we find out, it's like, oh my God, it's even worse than I expected. Like, yes, I'm going to just go onto the top of a hill and cause every blood molecule in my body to instantly
She wanted to freeze to death, but she didn't realize that since water expands,
And she couldn't get it all to freeze at the same time. So it was a slow process, but it was already started and apparently was quite gruesome. And yeah, her husband shared that mental picture with a lot of people, many of whom were not okay with that.
Yeah, yeah. So it's interesting to me that for all the Remillards are prolific. You know, they're basically like they're your French Canadian psychic Kennedy family, because there's a billion of them, and some of them are wealthy industry types who are still rubbing shoulders with wealthy with wealthy political types. You know, French Canadian and psychic, except instead of, you know, Massachusetts and Catholic. But for all of that, like the actual labor, or rather the idea that, you know, raising children is something that isn't innately monstrous or damaging is not an idea that Julian May backs in any way, shape, or form. And I'm curious, like, I wonder how much of that is deliberate and how much of that might have been the result of being a member of a generation where forging the type of career she had would have been considerably more difficult than it is for Western women who work as artists today.
And that's totally, you know, not just possible, but likely.
Yeah. I mean, because she's a phenomenal writer, and she was really prolific. She didn't just write these things. She also had a couple other series going, and I know she also kept the lights on by writing like lots and lots of nonfiction books for young people, like the types of books you would have had in Scholastic catalogs and in your classroom growing up. So this is clearly somebody who wouldn't have been able to stop writing even if she had wanted to. But I do wonder, because she did also have kids, and Anne McCaffrey was a contemporary of hers, and McCaffrey's another one whose writing on the subject I've always found fascinating, because the way she works around it is, oh, we just foster them off. There are women out there who like to do parenting, so we let them do it, and the rest of us just ride our dragons. And I've always wondered if it was a generational thing where you had these women who were like, no, I want the right to creative absorption, the same that men have, and I don't understand why I can't have it. And some of that gets... So they effectively rewrite that world, and they work out their own feelings, their own ambivalence about parenthood through their stories.
Ooh, fascinating. Because you're right. Like, I hadn't really put that together, but it's totally very similar in the Dragon Riders.
Oh yeah, no, I love it because. Yeah. You know, when I was younger, like, because you and I both read the Dragon Riders of Pern, we read them like in middle school and so on, right?
Yep,
and I remember
reading
at the time, and at the time I'm like, that would be awesome. Because if, you know, if you're arguing with your mom, you're like, having a foster mom who gets me would be great.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah, right? And because the way it's presented in the books is, oh, this way people with temperaments can match up and bring out the best in each other. You're like, this sounds fantastic. And then, like, as an adult on the flip side of it, and as somebody who actually, I love my job, I love my career, and I do have to put some effort into doing creative endeavors on the side, because I do also have a daughter, going back through and reading through and being like, all of her protagonists have sloughed off parenting onto somebody else. that was written by a woman who got really, really angry over having to figure out childcare and writing deadlines. And I'm picking up a little bit of that with the Julian May too.
Hear, hear.
Yeah. But I do really like, though, Dorothy in this book. She's one of my favorite characters, precisely because she is complex and messy and deeply emotional and has her own integrity, and she's creative and earnest and just, you know, there's a lot said about quote unquote Saint Jack, but I really feel like we have a much stronger sense of who Dorothy is, and she's just fantastic.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, for all that the last book was called Jack the Bodiless and talked a lot about him, I feel like the little tiny bits that we get of the two of them sort of talking to each other and interacting with each other throughout this book gave me a much more clear view of who Jack is as a person in this book.
He's just like this friendly, curious weirdo.
Yeah. And, you know, the fact that he does feel kind of lonely, and he is, you know, not really ashamed of what he is, but recognizes that the rest of the world is maybe not super, super cool with it. And just, like, it's in reflection to Dorothy that I feel like I get the most personality from him. Yeah. So that was kind of fascinating. And I feel like she's a really good character. She's well-defined. Mm-hmm. She's not necessarily a character that I love, because, you know, I tend to relate to characters in, like, you know, if it's a character that I would want to hang out with, like, that's a character I like. So Rogi, yes, Rogi. Like, I would love to hang out with him.
Yes.
I would not want to spend a lot of time with Thee, because she's, you know, for all that I understand what's going on underneath the surface there in a way that, you know, probably nobody else in that actual universe of the books really does, except maybe Jack. She never loosens up. That's not a part of her personality. She's very stiff. She's, you know, sort of formal, and is, whether she's wearing a mask that's not actually a mask or a physical mask, like, you don't really know who the real her is. And that's not the kind of person that I, you know, glom onto as a human being. Yeah. So she's not my favorite character in the book, but I do think she's very, very well developed.
So you said something that I wanted to bounce off you too, which is that you got a better sense of Jack when he was interacting with Dorothy. Mm-hmm. And I think one of my favorite things about this book is getting a sense of Jack when he's interacting with Mark. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask two questions. And the first was, did you get that sense as well, or did Jack's personality come out more for you with Dorothy than it does for Mark?
I thought it came out way more with Dorothy than it did for Mark. It was interesting because, you know, we started with the first four books, which take place 6 million years ago, and we already know that the family ghost is actually Mark, you know, 6 million years in his future. So I feel like in this book, it's sort of like Julian May is taking it as read that Mark is the character. We know how much she loves that character. Like, he swept in to the Pliocene era and stole the show. And
he swept into, like, the last tenth of this book and stole the show too.
So it seemed like, you know, he doesn't pop up a lot in this book, certainly toward the beginning of it. But every time he does, it's sort of like,
it gooses everything.
Yeah, it just kind of feels like this is her, you know, putting, you know, he's the tentpole character, so he shows up every now and then just because, remember, I exist and I'm super important. And I'm going to say, and Rogi's going to say a few words now about how much more super important he's going to be down the road. So you keep getting these teases and stuff. And I feel like the few interactions we get between Mark and Jack here didn't really feel all that momentous to me, in part because I didn't feel like anything that Mark did in this book was momentous. It was just sort of like it was all reminders about how powerful he is and how good looking he is and tall and dark he is in his black jeans and his, you know,
Mephistopheles. Yep. I was gonna say, I have to disagree just a tiny bit, because there's the scene at the wedding where
that's the one
they're talking about it, and Mark at one point was like, well, it'll be tough luck for my project if I get fried because bodiless bozo here thinks he's in love. And I actually laughed aloud when I read that passage.
Such a great line.
And another part of me was like, they're teasing each other like siblings, and you almost never get that kind of interaction. I like that through these books, like, Mark does get the treatment that he's special, that he's somehow separate from everybody, that his specialness makes him almost not human. And oh, the irony, because that's what he wishes.
I will say that scene, I did get, I think, a lot from Jack in that scene and from Mark, because, like, I did appreciate, like you said, the fact that they are joking with each other like brothers, which is great. But I kind of lumped that in with Jack being reflected off of Dorothy simply because it was also about her. Like, it's his love for her. So the interaction was with Mark. So that is true. It was an interaction between the two of them, but it was related to her.
And the book kind of opens with the same thing, where Fury is eavesdropping on the two of them and observes their interplay and their back and forth. And at one point, Jack says something and Mark answers him in a string of French profanities. And Jack is like, I can't translate that. Tell me what it is. Tell me what it is. And again, I liked that because it does more, in my mind, to illustrate the central tragedy of Mark Remillard in that he was capable of having genuinely gratifying connections with people. They were just few and far between because, you know, again, he was very smart and he is not wired like everybody else. Mm-hmm. And Jack was a brother and a friend and somebody that, you know, he respected and envied. So like this book is a little bit of, you can like, Mark hasn't done the full slide down into temptation and become the Lord of Hell, but boy, howdy, are they just foreshadowing it all the way through. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, that scene actually that you mentioned, I had kind of almost forgotten it, but it is kind of a masterful scene in that it is in miniature, like a representation of sort of what happens, because you do have, like you said, those lovely moments of them, you know, jawing back and forth, you know, I think this would work. No, I think you should try it this way. And like back and forth brothers. And it takes 5 hours or whatever for Mark to do this tiny, tiny little adjustment to make this brain board work the way that they want it to. And it doesn't quite work out. So like they do some test run and it's not great. And they come up with this other idea. Jack's like, well, why don't we try it this way, the way that I suggested it? And like, let me adjust it. I'll be able to adjust it quicker than you do. And it had taken Mark like 5 hours to do this adjustment, and it's like 20 minutes for Jack to do, to undo it and redo it in the way that he wanted to in the first place. So you have the brothers bonding a little bit, and then you have the brother who literally has no body and is, you know, the least human of all of them, who is much, much more powerful and able to do certain things that Mark really wants to be able to do. Yeah. So like you get that little hint of the jealousy that he's feeling, and he hasn't, you know, even by the end of the book, he hasn't given into sort of the temptation yet, but you have that seed planted. Like, I mean, it's been planted before, but this is watering that seed in a really special way.
She's paying a lot of attention. Well, what's really funny is there's a whiff of sulfur as they're working, which, oh my God, really, really? Uh-huh. But the passage I highlighted for that was the envy had lately begun to undermine the compassion he felt for young Jack's grotesque physical condition. Was mental man really to be pity, or was he the embodied one, the true unfortunate? What would it be like to be free of nearly all of the body's needs and limitations, to be able to channel all vital energies towards cerebration? And so we see that Mark has a really ambivalent relationship to his physical body to begin with. And you know, Mark's profound ambivalence towards being a man or at all, period, just begins to develop. And like you said, it's a very special seed. She waters it really early on. Mm-hmm. Mark ends up having a moment with his sister.
Yep.
And long story short, what happens is Mark doesn't realize that the woman he's talking to is his sister. Who's one of the Hydra units that's psychically bonded to and manipulated by Fury. And she's under orders to find out as much as possible about Mark's brain-boosting helmet. Because if you think metapsychics are powerful now, wait until they're mechanically augmented, because they'll be that much more powerful. And one of the central, the Galactic Republic has to debate type of things for this book is, does the milieu offer brain boosting technology, or does it outlaw it? And there's a scene where Madeline is trying to beguile Mark into letting her use the helmet, and she taunts him with, are you Merlin, the greatest wizard of all, unless you succumb to a woman? And again, it's a whole lot of Mark has really, really a really, really conflicted relationship with his body and with hormonal impulses and relationships and on and on it goes. So I feel like this is very, very deliberately done. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so much so that, like, you know, after it's done and Maddie, his sister, has tricked him / coerced him into like, I didn't even entirely understand exactly what physically was happening there, and I was okay with that. I did not need to, but it was very much, you know, taunting him and bringing him like to the brink of death and then back, and that like totally got him off. And you know, she says, I will, you know, someday I'm gonna kill you.
I love
this
you
way.
I hate you. Someday I'm gonna kill you.
Yep. And he's totally cool with that. He's like, yes please. So definitely giving us a bit of a glimpse into into Mark's tormented mind when it comes to, like you said, you know, sexuality and relationships and stuff. But then afterwards, you know, because she's so brain boosted, she's able to erase all of the, you know, explicit memory of this from his mind, and he's sort of only left with the
subliminal
realizations.
Suggestion. Yeah,
yeah, the realizations about himself. So when he wakes up, he's got the helmet out, doesn't remember taking it out because he doesn't even remember having her over. The helmet's out, and like he can tell that he assumes that he's been masturbating and that he used the helmet to do it, which he finds like very distasteful, and he can't remember. But that's what he jumps to.
That's
as
what
an
he
assumption
takes away from it. Yeah,
and he buys that, so it's like, yeah. Wow, Mark.
Well, it's the whole episode is just, it's because as a reader you're supposed to be like, oh god, incest, this is disgusting. And what's interesting though is how closely May couples sexual perversion with the Hydra. And like she goes out of her way to mention a couple different times in the book that that they have voracious and intemperate sexual appetites.
Mm-hmm. Especially Celine, who is the one that dies in this book.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Apparently enjoys having sadomasochistic sex. Like they go out of their way to mention that detail, for example, which it's one of these things where like, did we need to know that? And
Also, she's kink-shaming, which is, you know, looking at it from this era, is kind of like, not as cool as it probably seemed at the time.
No, and like, the thing that makes me deeply uncomfortable about all about the way she writes about Fury is, on one level, they are meant to be terrifying, because you're talking about four gifted metapsychics who work in concert with one another and are effectively vampires and like murdering people and like making people suffer. And really, and you're supposed to be like, oh my gosh, it's terrible. But what I really find uncomfortable now when I sit with it is there's a real suggestion that they brought it on themselves.
Uh-huh.
And I just like, I have a hard time with that, because there's a passage at the beginning where Fury is eavesdropping, and they're talking about, oh, Jack is a child, so you know he's innocent. He's innocent of everything because he's a child. He doesn't understand human he doesn't fully understand adult motivation and moral compromises and so on and so forth. And then he was only a child with limited experience in matters of good and evil is the way he's explicitly referred to. And then a little bit later in the book, the way Rogi describes the Hydra is they were quote unquote tempted while still in utero. Mm-hmm. So what that suggests, the use of the word tempted suggests that these children already had a sense of moral right and wrong and made an informed choice, which preposterous, even if they're like psychically gifted.
Yeah, she's got a real double standard here, doesn't she?
But it gets worse, Erica, because when they have like the family conference and they're all talking later, Anne says it all comes down to that fatal yes. Let me see if I can find the note. Oh, it's Catherine, not Anne, excuse me. What Catherine says, because she's the one who actually does rehab with different victims. This is Catherine who says that monsters, even if they're abused, what she says is somewhere along the line, a nascent monster chooses to do what he or she knows is evil. Genuine insanity or lack of culpability may follow, but in the beginning, there is always the fatal yes.
That's right.
And I'm like, really? You're arguing that a bunch of fetuses are morally responsible for what happened to them?
Sounds like she is.
And I really have a difficult time with that. Mm-hmm. The same way I have a difficult time with, I just have a difficult time with the idea that somehow these children have agency in the womb, moral agency, the same kind of moral agency that's equivalent to an adult, whereas Jack the Bodiless is, quote unquote, only a child with limited experience of right and wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
double standard.
Yeah. So, like, part of me is all, you know, four psychic vampires working in concert is already terrifying enough. You didn't have to also like stack the deck against them before they were born, and then throw in a few details about gratuitous sexual activity just to make sure we were tilted further into the Hydra bed.
Honestly, I feel like she sort of missed a trick, missed an opportunity to make Fury even more terrifying and powerful seeming, because, you know, by having Kat say that thing about, you know, there's always the choice there, like, that, you're right, it hammers at home that somehow these five babies made the choice to be evil, whereas if that choice was taken away from them by Fury, that makes Fury all the more evil and scary and like a great big bad. And that's not how she decided to play it.
And it makes the Hydra more tragic, because these are children who never had a choice.
Yep. But apparently she really likes her ideas about right and wrong and good and evil. And I think that maybe she leaned a little too hard into that. And, I agree. It's a sour note. It really is.
Yeah. So it's something I had a little trouble with. And the other reason I find it a lot more problematic now is, it's part of a larger conversation they have where they talk about, you know, Anne says, oh, the engendering of a moral monster is one of life's great mysteries. But there's one thing psychologists and theologians agree on. In almost every case, monsters are made, not conceived. And this somehow leads into a discussion where that cohort of the dynasty more or less concludes, with Dennis's help no less, that they more or less conclude that Victor was probably sexually abused by his father.
Yeah, which is interesting, because that's something that was not even hinted at in the two intervention books.
No, not at all. So they go on to, oh, Victor was abused, and that's what made him a monster. And I thought to myself, imagine if you're an abuse survivor and you're reading these books, and all of a sudden it turns into, well, of course he's a monster. He was abused, and then he chose to become terrible. And I thought, how would that feel?
Uh-huh.
I'm sputtering. I'm still outraged by it, because I keep thinking, you know, to sit there and say that you hold some moral culpability because of how you choose to react to something beyond your control like this, it's a really tough idea to square. So maybe this loops back to what we talked about at the beginning of this podcast, which is that there's an almost shocking lack of empathy among people who can read each other's minds.
Yes. Yeah. Like, does that somehow, like you were saying in the beginning, like, does that somehow quell empathy? Does it tamp it down simply because you know all of this stuff, so you lose the ability to feel it quite as deeply as you might otherwise have been able to?
I don't know. It's just, it's I don't know if it's a failure of authorial imagination or if she felt so strongly that she wanted to get out these leitmotifs about the importance of choosing who you want to become, because that's what this book is about, ultimately, is Dorothy chooses to be all of the roles that she assumes, all of the masks that she takes on and puts off, all of the moral absolution she grants to herself. Dorothy chooses that. That's the idea. The Hydra all chose it under those premises. Mark is on the precipice of saying a fatal yes to something. Like, that's the theme of the book, and that's important to her, clearly. That's a value that she hammers again and again. I'm calling into question the validity of that value.
Yeah.
While saying, fair. It's a ripping good yarn.
Yep.
And there are so many small details in this book I love. Like, I love when they have the conference and they note that everybody has gone bananas for just overly ornate and Baroque styles, because it's a reaction to enforced austerity and great societal upheaval. And I was like, oh, that's a brilliant piece of pop sociology. That's great. Yeah. Like, I love the details on on the social gatherings. I love when Rogi name drops brands. But there's a lot of tough ideas at the heart of this book, where when I look at them more carefully, I find myself asking why is this here? Is this here to advance the plot and we're supposed to react like this? Or are you arguing this because it's necessary to the bigger point you want to make?
Yeah, one of those things for me was, and I think we touched on this in the last episode of the podcast a little bit, because of the end of the previous book, how, you know, at the end of the previous book, Rogi is saying, you know, it's such a shame because nobody will ever love him, you know, because now Jack has no body. And like the scene that you were just talking about, with Mark and Jack at the beginning, there's a description of Jack as grotesque because he has mm-hmm. no body and he's just a brain. And I feel like at the time I read this the first time, that all kind of made sense to me. But now mm-hmm. I am much farther in the future and I have completely sort of changed the way that I think about what makes people beautiful and mm-hmm. what makes people interesting to me. And I think about, I have spent a lot of time interacting with the disability rights community. Mm-hmm. And the idea that losing a limb or having scars on your face or any one of a whole bunch of different physical differences makes you less human or less desirable or any of those sorts of things. So every time we came across a point in this book where Jack's physical condition is pointed to as something that makes him grotesque or makes him less desirable to the world at large, it's like, I understand why she put that in there. And I understand that that is the way that this fiction that she has written, the society, like they view him that way because he has no body and he's a floating brain. Therefore, that's tragic. And I mean, I just, me as a reader, as a person now, I do not see that as tragic at all.
No, like I see
zero tragedy in what has happened to Jack. Not only does he have all of these great psychic powers and stuff, but he is able to create any kind of physical body he wants for himself. Like he was mm-hmm. running around like animals, like, you know, trying on different bodies as a kid just for the heck of it. Like there's just nothing to that. And then you get the scene with the two of them, Jack and Dee, in the machine, you know, burrowing under the crust of the earth for 14 hours, and he has to disembody himself in order to be able to use the rig appropriately. And like, she's surprised, she's like, but you know, but your natural form isn't disgusting at all, or however she puts it. And I'm like, yeah, duh. So
I never understood why it would be so bad to be disincarnated to begin with. And after years of watching Futurama with floating brains, I'm like, this seems kind of awesome, honestly. Uh-huh. Like,
I think we were supposed to take Dorothy's reaction as, you know, she's different from other people because she doesn't see that as as disgusting. You know, she definitely earlier on in the book, when she finds out that that's the truth about him, she recoils and she thinks, oh my gosh, that's just so terrible. And so I think we're supposed to think, oh, she's a much, you know, kinder, more generous person than most because she sees him and she does not recoil or whatever. But I that is one of the things that I find myself rolling my eyes at. And, you know, I feel like somebody with a severe physical disability reading this book now might have a similar reaction. Mm-hmm. To someone who is an abuse survivor reading about Victor being abused.
Well, you're
abused.
Doomed to be a monster now. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely some sort of ouchy feelings there.
I feel like there's probably, and this might be a discussion more towards the third book, but I feel like she's working through something qua one of the central tenets of Christianity, i.e. the body, you know, Christ's sacrifice. This is Christ made a sacrifice for humanity. And so the ritual of Eucharist is to take of my body, take of my blood. So there might be something going on there where Jack is bodiless and Mark resents his body. And oh, it's there are going to be sacrifices made along the line and all that. But like, there are, like you said, there are probably many, many more physically unsettling things in this world than a naked brain that doesn't feel pain floating around talking to you.
Mm-hmm. Hear, hear.
And I can't quite comprehend why he's regarded with such pity, where they're like, oh, he's only going to have a normal lifespan. And I'm like, yeah, in a family full of kajillionaires, it's not like he's going to be, you know, suffering a whole lot.
He can literally fly. Like,
yeah. Like, if I were them, what I'd be worried about is that the most powerful brain on the planet develops Alzheimer's. Like, that would be something you worry about.
Yeah.
But, oh, he can't have a body. And so what? You know, there are tons of Remillards who have bodies. They're all, you know, they'll live. It's okay. And It seems like such a weird symbolic hill to die on that this is terrible, and I can't help but think that we're heading towards some grand, it's a metaphor for Christianity type thing, uh-huh. with bodies and lacks thereof and temptation, and you know, because otherwise, like, you don't take away your protagonist's body in book number one if it's not going to count by book number three.
Yeah, so. Chekhov's disembodiment. Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, there's your podcast title right there.
So, you know, speaking of Victor and his abuse that we never got any hint of before, to me, that felt a little bit like a retcon. I feel like if she had had that thought already, she might have planted something about it in the two intervention books just to give us that, like, a hint of it. And it just kind of felt like it came out of nowhere. And that was one of two things in this book that really felt like a retcon to me, because, you know, sort of in the middle, we get Hydra talking to each other, sort of complaining about Fury when they're having that moment, like, you know, should we work against Fury because, you know, Fury doesn't actually want us because, you know, Fury tried to get Mark and then Fury tried to get Jack and now this kid. And then there was that Remillard woman. And I was like, wait, what now? I had to I read that paragraph like three times being like, what am I forgetting? I don't remember that. And the reason I didn't remember it is because there was never anything about it. It was a reveal to come up in like the next chapter or the chapter after that about how Anne had been approached by Fury and then was able to say no to Fury. And I was like, okay, I feel like maybe you just came up with this and you just put it into this book and that was not actually part of the plan and you just needed to get from point A to point B and this was point A, you know, 8.5 to get you there. I don't know. Did it stick out to you? Or
yes. Okay. And it reminds me a lot of the revelation that Felice was abused. Mm-hmm. Because you remember in books one and two of the Pliocene epic, it's basically, oh, she's a fiercely talented athlete and she's a sociopath. Wow. And that's fearsome enough on its own. And then she gets captured and she gets tortured and you find out it's kind of a kink. And then May posits that the reason it's a kink is because she had been sexually abused by her parents. And so her brain was scrambled from birth. Sociopaths are made, not born, that whole thing. And honestly, Felice would have been fine without the abuse component there. Mm-hmm. And it felt super personal in that book and the next. And I thought, okay, maybe May found something out. Maybe she either worked with a survivor of childhood abuse or there was a childhood abuse thing going on in one of her church communities or something along those lines. And she writes about how it damages people because this is what she's seeing. This is how she works out her anger. I don't know. We never find out. But she effectively did the same thing again here. And like you said, it comes without warning. And I can imagine that she may have been writing things like that because from her perspective, the damage that an abuser does is unforgivable and has reverberations and and is terrible. But again, I keep thinking if you're an abuse victim who is reading an author and bop, bop, bopping along, and then all of a sudden you read a bunch of passages positing that you're set, that you're now on the path to monsterhood because of your anger and your fury and your and your sense of helplessness and your shame. Like, it just, it feels like her intentions and her execution are pulls apart. And it also feels unnecessary, which makes it a little even harder to swallow than it would be otherwise.
Yep.
And for all that, I did have a hard time with a lot of things in this book. Some of the ideas are very tough to wrap your brain around and try to reckon with them from a 2020 perspective. It's still a ripping good yarn. Mm-hmm. Like, you have a murder mystery that gets solved and you have planetary capers. And again, it's effectively psychic Kennedy's Go to Space. And it's a beach read in a lot of ways and it's fun. But there's thorns in there too, as it were.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, that's part of the nature of doing a podcast or a book club or anything like that, where you pick something apart, is to find all of those little threads that you can pull at and be like, oh, these are things that stood out. These are things that bothered me. But yeah, overall, I'm quite enjoying this. Like I have said previously, the first read or two through these books, I didn't dig this trilogy all that much. And now I'm enjoying it so much more. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that I have a lot more life experience and can relate to some of these characters. And I recognize an awful lot more about the way people interact with each other in society and the ramifications, you know, the ideas of ramifications of extra powers like this and how that would happen. You know, I've read and consumed an awful lot more media that touches on the same themes. So I'm very much enjoying this. And I really did have a good time reading through this book. And it was, once again, I scheduled it out like 30 pages a day for a couple of weeks. And I would get to the end of my chapter at the end of 30 pages. And I would be like, I want to keep reading. But I would set it down. And then I would just find myself, like, you know, an hour later being like, oh, just thinking about it.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen for every book that I read. So this is one of the not entirely rare, but this is one of the special books where it stays in my brain and it makes me keep thinking about it even when I'm not reading it. And I think that for me, that's the number one best thing I can say about a good book is that I can't, you know, I can't quite shake it. I keep thinking about it. And I totally did with this.
Yeah, no, this is, you know, I did say beach read, and I know that can be a denigrating term, but it's I wouldn't say escape is so much, it's absorbing, because unlike you, I basically sat on the couch, got up when my Apple Watch told me to get up. and, you know, just read and really just enjoyed falling into the story and being absorbed by it and finding all the places where, you know, May is very good at structuring her story with a lot of consistent beats. It never drags, and it rewards paying attention with callbacks. And, you know, I really loved the craftsmanship behind it. And, you know, for all that, I had questions like, wait, if redaction or healing is an ability, are people who score really high in redaction automatically conscripted into medical services? What happened to health insurance? Does everyone have, like, no, because I find myself asking questions. I do love the future casting she does. Like, here are the cultural currents that happen. Fashion does this, or food does that, or this is how people respond to aliens in their midst. And I find myself wishing she would have, like, gamed out, here's how insurance got affected, or here's how therapy changed, or rather, now that we have telekinesis, here's how heavy machine operators respond.
I would have been okay with some of that stuff if it was, you know, sort of doled out to us in an aside of like a sentence or two. The one thing that made me kind of snicker a little bit about this book was, because do you remember back in the Pleistocene Exile books where we were just like, oh my God, mountain climbing. I don't need to know any more about what you need to climb the face of a mountain. I did feel a little bit that way when Dee is first learning to fly and we learn about these harvesting machines that are harvesting the aphrodisiac plants from the air. And like she clearly learned a lot about what it takes, you know, to create flight in an aircraft.
And she showed her work.
She showed her work a little bit more than I needed. I didn't feel like it bogged things down quite as much as the mountain climbing stuff did. But it was, I had little, you know, little flashbacks again. But it did lead to some really cool sequences. Like the idea that there is one particular kind of air plant that when it gets all riled up, it sticks out a whole bunch of spikes, and you have this scene that like just sticks out in my head of poor Kenny, who has been, you know, he's not harvesting, he's flying a ship that is basically the bin for all of the other harvesters to put their stuff in, and some harvester has not been very careful, and every single storage cell in his ship apparently has these bad kinds of air plants in them, and it's so full that suddenly they all go bananas at the same time, and he's watching his ship disintegrate around him because all of these cells are being pulled apart from the inside.
Oh God, just sounds like a terrible way to go too.
So maybe that sequence wouldn't have been quite as, you know, gripping to me if I didn't understand as much about the ins and outs and the structure of all of those ships from the beginning, because I maybe wouldn't have been able to picture it quite so clearly if I didn't understand how all of the storage cells and those things were very separated and were very different. And you had this kind of thing on the inside and that kind of thing on the outside. And sometimes you'd have to go outside of the ship and climb on the outside and clear out the gunk. And it was just, you know, there was a lot of that, but it led to a good scene. So I'm not faulting her too much. Yeah.
So you want to know what was an unexpected payoff? I found a documentary on YouTube. Since some of my life is now dedicated to finding things on YouTube that can supplement schoolwork, I found this 50-minute documentary on ecological diversity in the High Alps.
Ooh.
And now that I can actually see what the Matterhorn looks like, and all of and basically I have now that I have you know, moving pictures in my head thanks to like the drone shots and seeing what the peaks look like and watching how the weather rolls in and things change in a dime and this is what the streams are like I'm like, oh all of a sudden many more of those tedious scenes in mountain climbing have a little bit more texture for me, because I can go, in my head the image has been swapped in for this is what the mountain looks like, this is what the stones are like, this is what happens when the avalanche happens, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so. Probably people who are avid like rock climbers and mountain climbers either really loved those sequences or were really mad about whatever little thing she got wrong. And same thing with, you know, pilots maybe were very excited about that one section in this book, or annoyed because it wasn't right.
Yeah. Now, she, given the number of like science nonfiction books she wrote for like young and middle grade readers, I'm pretty sure that the work was like, I trust her to get those details right. Mm-hmm. So, but I agree with you. Every once in a while, like there's a discussion or she veers off to explain something that will make sense, like five passages hence, and you're like, I didn't want to know what a diatreme was today. More geology. Why?
Now I know.
Yeah. She loves her geology, though. She really does.
Yeah, she absolutely does. Which, you know, I like picturing diamonds. So like that's
I loved the shower of diamonds with the cold steam. Mm-hmm. Like that just made my imagination just imagine them coming up.
Definitely. I also kind of like the idea that, you know, so Rogi has the Great Carbuncle, which we now know, which we know is a diamond, like a perfect diamond, when he first discovered it was a diamond, it was worth, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars or whatever. And now, because humanity has settled so many other planets where, like here on Caledonia, diamonds are literally like you find them on the path as you're walking through the woods. He's like, this is probably only worth a couple thousand dollars now. What a shame. Like that was another one of those just sort of nice little societal details, like that's a thing that's changed. Diamonds are not like quite the cool, like super rare thing that they used to be anymore. Oh well.
Yeah. I love that. I love little world changing details like that. I'm super excited for I am both super excited to get to the culmination of the 9 books that preceded. Or rather, I should say the culmination, the 8 books that preceded it. Yeah, the culmination, because Jack the Magnificat, which will have a lot to have a lot to live up to, as it were, since there's a lot of stuff that's going to need payoff there.
Yeah, and I'm I tend to like beginnings more than endings, so it's already sort of got a mark against it. And like, you know, being able to stick the landing is a tough thing. But, you know, I remember thinking that The Adversary actually did a pretty good job of sticking the landing of those first 4 books. So, you know, not remembering what actually happens in Magnificat, I have some hope that I'm not going to be super disappointed. So that's cool.
Yeah. I will admit that after the first introduction of Alex Mannion and the rest of the gang, I did go back and reopen some of the last 2 Pliocene epic books and start looking for who they turned into in exile to see if there's any hint of that, or if this is going to be something where like, okay, they were these people pre-revolution and it's just they share a name, that's it. You know, but we'll see.
It'll be fun. I'm looking forward
to 8 books down, 1 to go.
Yes, so close.
I know.
All right, well listeners, we very much appreciate you listening in, whether you've read these books or not, whether you've read the
recently. If you haven't, please let us know why you're listening to this. I'm so curious. Mm-hmm. I'm so curious as to why you're listening in if you haven't read the books.
Yeah, and you can find us on Twitter. I don't remember our handle exactly. I think it's Saga of Rereading or something. You can find it on the website.
Yep. But, yeah, or follow me and Erica on Twitter. Both of us retweet the tweets.
Yes, exactly. So, I am Erica.
I am Lisa.
And thank you once again for joining us on this epic journey. Saga of Rereading Epics is a proud part of the Incomparable Podcast Network. Visit theincomparable.com for more geeky podcasts. And while you're there, you can become a member, support the show, and get future episodes of this podcast right now.